It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, even though we talk about our identities more than ever, that doesn't mean people will vote along identity lines. Women voters aren't automatically voting for Hillary Clinton, and Latino voters aren't necessarily voting for Ted Cruz. We'll find out about the decline of identity politics. But first, we turn to Milwaukee County. A report released today shows new information about the death toll from opioids, broken down by gender, race, and age. And the findings are slated to be used to inform new public policy in the Milwaukee area. Here to tell us more about that report is Alderman Michael Murphy, whose office released the report. He represents Milwaukee's 10th District and is president of the city's Common Council. Alderman Murphy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, what kind of data were you looking for when you began this new report?
Well, we wanted to look at the unfortunate opiate and heroin overdeaths since 2012 in the Milwaukee County area. Felt very strongly in 2014, after I put together a summit in southeastern Wisconsin of all the counties in the area, that we need to look at different strategies, and I'm a big believer in making sure we make thoughtful, informed decisions based on the analysis. So I met with the medical examiner in Milwaukee County, and he was very kind, Brian Peterson, to share with me this data. Since 2012 to 2016, 888 people have lost their lives to heroin or opiate overdose deaths. And most people would be surprised, I think, that the fact that the average age is a 43-year-old, and generally it's a white Caucasian male. 60% of the people who are passing away are male, and nearly 70% are white. And it shows the distribution, unfortunately, is across all all areas within the county.
So there were some surprises in there, beginning with the age. Now we have, I think, this image in our minds of people affected by heroin and opioids being young people, maybe in their 20s, but you're talking about an average death in the 40s.
It's true, and I think it says a lot why I want to look at the data. When we decide as public policymakers to make decisions about prevention and what our targeted audience is, I think naturally I think we're all very concerned about our children and what's going on. But at the same time, when we craft those messages together, we should recognize that the spatial relationship and also the age distribution, the audience that you're looking at may not be what you think it is. So, young people certainly are overdosing, and we need to focus on that. But nearly 50% of overdoses in Milwaukee County are occurring between the ages of 30 and 59.
So you've got this older age group, and it sounds as though when you break it down by race, it looks as though among African Americans, the age is even higher.
It is. For African-American black overdose victims, skew a bit higher. 38% of overdoses are occurring between ages of 50 to 59. And it shows, I think, culturally, and this is maybe based on just some assumptions I'm making at this time, that there was, such a terrible epidemic of the heroin in the 60s and 70s in the African-American community. It just has not gotten its roots back in. It's not to say that, unfortunately, that won't change in the future, but I think we want to recognize that it's a big distinction.
And more men than women were dying of this. Did that surprise you?
No. Surprisingly, I met with a lot of families, and most of them I meet with, generally I hear from either mothers or family members who have lost brothers or sons. At the same time, when you look at the statistics for women, if you dive a little bit more deeper into it, you see oxycodone is a higher rate of the overdose deaths. So, what we hear nationally and in many ways locally it mirrors that is that people generally get hooked on heroin as a result of being introduced to opiates through perhaps prescriptions, legal prescriptions like oxycodone, and then with the greater regulation on pill doctors and the medical establishment, people don't have easy access to that and then move to heroin, which right now is cheaper than oxycodone on the streets of Milwaukee.
And your office, as you mentioned, you looked at the toxicology report. Could you tell us a little bit about what opiates in particular were affecting the most people?
Well, obviously oxycodone, but hydrocodone. And surprisingly also what we found in the data is showing anti-anxiety medication is being found much more in the last several years in the toxicology reports with people who have overdosed. So that's a very telling thing, and I've met with Dr. Hargarten from the medical college, who we're going to partner with them on looking at this data in more detail and trying to come up with prevention strategies. Is why is that the case, or why are we seeing more anti-anxiety and medication found in toxicology reports? I think it's a critical question. We need to inform medical professionals about what's going on.
So you're saying anti-anxiety medication is being found in the system of some of these people. So you're not saying that contributed to the death, but maybe these people are experiencing anxiety, is that?
No, I think it's contributing to the death. A lot of this anti-anxiety medication is a respiratory decreases your respiratory system, and obviously narcotics do the same. So combined with the two of them is a deadly cocktail.
And you're seeing something new as well, something that's often used in surgery to knock people out for surgery.
Yeah, this is a very, very disturbing trend. Fentanyl is a drug in which generally it's used in, by anesthesiologists. And unfortunately, for a time period, we only saw a very small percentage of people who were dying of that in 2012 through the 16 in their system. But we've seen a huge increase just in the last 3 months with overdose deaths. And just give you a perspective, fentanyl is 100 times more powerful than morphine. So, and it's 50 times more powerful than heroin. So as the medical examiner, Brian Peterson, told me, your life depends sometimes on whether the dealer who's mixing fentanyl with heroin on a kitchen table in a bowl, if he moves that spoon to the left or the right too much. It's that deadly.
We're talking right now with Michael Murphy, alderman of Milwaukee's 10th District and president of the city's Common Council, talking about a new report released by his office on opioid deaths in Milwaukee County. And the CDC recently announced an effort to rein in some prescription opiates for treating chronic pain. And Milwaukee was also chosen to be part of a $2 million strategy led by the USDA to deal with the opioid problem. How do you think all of that might fit into what you're working on in your office?
Well, I work with Bob Bell from the local DEA office, and they'll be doing a media campaign starting very soon. Running it on a number of TV stations, radio stations. And I think, you've got to look at this from a multidisciplinary aspect. Law enforcement is critical, interdiction, but prevention is a key issue, and then treatment. And so if you try and just arrest your way out of this problem, you'll never get there. We need to recognize that a lot of the crime being generated in the city of Milwaukee, unfortunately, is due to drug transactions. And if you look at the distribution of the people who are purchasing and buying drugs, it's throughout the whole community, and I think people forget that. But working with the DEA, they recognize the importance. We're one of four cities in the country that get a 360 strategy that they're, we're really, really pilot as a country at doing that. And I'm hopeful that, with this grant that I'm working on with the medical college, that we'll also be a recipient of federal money that deals with President Obama put in his budget to deal with prevention also. People don't understand in the context, more people are dying of drug overdoses than certainly violent crime and certainly even automobile accidents. And since 2005, we've nearly seen a 500% increase.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that, because I know you've said that you've crunched the numbers, you've looked at all this data, and you concluded that the opioid epidemic affects everybody, that nobody's isolated. What do you want people to know about why they should be invested in turning this around, even if they don't seem to be affected at the moment?
It affects people in the workplace in ways they don't even understand in some context when you talk about productivity. If a mother or father has a child who's an addict, there is a reason why they're missing work all the time, or maybe they'll be out of work permanently. When you have all these lives that are really lost, it has a dramatic impact on the economics of your community, let alone the cost of enforcement, treatment, prevention. Everyone has a vested interest in this, in reducing these numbers and finding better solutions. And I'm committed to working toward that with my across party lines. The one positive thing we saw, Veronica, is in 2014 and 15, we did see a bit of a plateau in the heroin overdoses in Milwaukee County. So perhaps the legislation passed last year is having some impact in our community. And I think probably why I want to have a little more research on that is the impact of Narcan and whether Narcan is having an impact in terms of preventing a lot of deaths. But we want to know, is this just, holding off to the eventual overdose, But I think those are some of the things this research, I think, hopefully will kind of create different strategies to try and fight this epidemic.
Alderman Murphy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Milwaukee Alderman Michael Murphy, whose office released a new report on opioid deaths in Milwaukee County. Look at identity and how important it may or may not be in the presidential election. Now, you might think that since we seem to be living in a time when conversations about race and gender and religion are in the headlines a lot, that identity-conscious voters might support candidates that share their background and their experiences. Well, our next guest says that in this presidential election, feminists aren't necessarily defaulting to Hillary Clinton, and Latinos aren't automatically supporting Ted Cruz, or Marco Rubio, for that matter, who dropped out of the race last week. Maria Muriel joins us now. She's digital editor for Public Radio International, and she reported on identity politics for PRI's Global Nation Exchange Project, which tells stories of immigrants in the United States. Maria, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what are we seeing right now with voter trends and the idea of identity politics, of voters supporting candidates who might have a similar background to them?
I think especially in this election, what's very different from the 2012 election and even the 2008 election is that typically in the media, we tend to want to write about, you know, politicians going after a certain demographic vote, like a politician going after the black vote or the Latino vote. And in this election, what I've been seeing in my reporting is that voting trends are, they might still be, for the most part, split that way, but not necessarily, it's not black and white. You know, people aren't, like you said, you know, I've reported on women who aren't automatically going to vote for Hillary Clinton because they want to see a woman president. And what's starkly different here than in, say, the 2008 election is that black voters in that year voted for President Obama overwhelmingly. He won like something like 80 or 90% of the black vote. Because that was a very historically important election for that part of the population.
So you're saying that the history making that could be in the offing for this election cycle, the first woman president, the first Jewish president, the first Cuban-American president, that doesn't carry the same historical weight as President Obama's election might have?
It doesn't appear to be, because I've talked to a lot of people who, you know, these women that aren't going to vote for Hillary Clinton just because they want to see a woman president. And, you know, you also hear people say that young people tend to support Bernie Sanders because they agree with his social Democrat policies. But it doesn't seem to be as clearly divided along demographic lines and generational lines as the media typically tends to present it. I just think that in this election year, we're seeing a lot more nuances in voter trends.
Is that, do you think, in part because the candidates themselves aren't talking that much about it? Hillary Clinton has not said to women, vote for me to see the first woman president so much. And Bernie Sanders, you know, has been sort of singled out as not talking a lot about his Jewish heritage either, even though, you know, he's identifiable as is Hillary Clinton, as is Ted Cruz. But is there not as much talk about it from the candidates themselves?
I think that might be a part of it, although I don't think that President Obama really touted his ethnicity as a reason to vote for, to be elected. Hillary Clinton has said, you know, if I got elected, I would be the first woman president. But you're right that Bernie Sanders doesn't really kind of promote his Jewish identity as a reason that he should be elected. I think, though, a reason for the very nuanced differences in voting trends this year is because as a society, as a country, we are talking about our identities a lot more. And we are sort of in this era where we want to define our identities a lot more and who we are. And, you know, there's a lot more of a conversation nationally about that. So I think that's kind of influencing people to not be pegged into a certain hole. You know, we don't want to let, just because we're female, we don't want to do this. We are female, but we are also, you know, maybe conservative or liberal. And there's just a lot more things at play than we've seen in past elections.
And you heard feminist icon Gloria Steinem, also Madeleine Albright, trying to sort of engage women in electing a woman president. It seemed to kind of backfire, that it was almost offensive to some feminists that, why would I just vote for a woman because I'm a woman? That's overly simplistic, that voters are more kind of embracing the Walt Whitman style of containing multitudes.
Yeah, you're right. And that I thought that was really interesting. And I think in that instance, it was sort of a clear generational divide, because Gloria Steinem and Madeleine Albright obviously come from a wave of feminism that is older than a lot of millennial voters today, who really don't want to just be, like I said, pushed into this voting block of female voter who's going to be predictably supportive of the female candidate. And I actually interviewed a father and daughter. I'm in Miami for some reporting this week, and I interviewed a Cuban-American father and daughter who the father voted for Marco Rubio in the Florida primary, and he did say that he voted for Marco Rubio because he could identify with him. You know, Marco Rubio is obviously out of the race now, but he grew up in Miami. He is a local here, and this man was saying, I voted for him because he is like me, he's one of us, and I would like to see him in the White House. And then this man's daughter was saying, well, you know, I didn't vote for Marco Rubio, and I'm Cuban-American too, and I grew up in Miami too, and I also didn't vote for Hillary Clinton because I'm a woman. I think she said she voted for Bernie Sanders because she agrees with his policies the most. And I think that's actually what's driving voters the most today, the policies of the candidates.
We're talking right now with Maria Muriel, digital editor at Public Radio International, where she recently has been reporting on identity politics in this presidential cycle. And you mentioned the young woman you talked to in Miami voting for Bernie Sanders. Now, it seems as though there you have a white man running for president, but there is a lot of apparently diversity among his supporters. What have you seen there?
Yeah, there seems to be, although, you know, in some southern states, Hillary Clinton won some states out from under him. And it has been reported that Bernie Sanders doesn't really have a lot of diverse support base. But what I'm trying to say and what I've seen in my reporting is that it's not all black and white, right? Like it's not, excuse me, it's not. Everything is not the way that the headlines will make you think. There's an exception to every rule, kind of. You know, even though a group of people might tend to vote a certain way, that doesn't mean that everybody within that group of people is going to go for the same candidate. And that doesn't seem to be as much of a rallying cry as it may have been in past elections.
You know, we talk a lot about, as we look at these primaries, who is going to get the Latino vote? Who is going to get the black vote? Do those terms even really apply in this election? Can we talk about it like that?
You know, we do talk about it like that. We certainly do in the media. I'm Latina. I'm from Peru, and I am white. I like to say that I'm allergic to the term Latino vote and black vote, just because I feel like it's not a monochromatic uniform thing, right? Especially with Latino identity in the U.S., you have Latinos that identify as white, you have Latinos that identify as black, you have Latinos that identify as Muslim, as a million other things. And this is what I'm talking about when I say there's a lot more nuance in the way that we refer to identity now, because sure, we might be part of one group, but we might also be a part of another. And that might have to do with the fact that we are a more diverse populace today.
And you said that the voters were voting more along policy, the policy of the candidates. Do you see that as something exceptional about this particular race, this particular moment in history? Or is this a change in the way voters are thinking?
You know, I don't think that I can speak historically about this, but I would like to think that usually in elections, we choose our candidates based on policy. I would like to think that that's always the case. However, if you look back at the 2008 election, just because having a black president for the first time is such a historically significant thing, I think it makes sense for the black electorate to sort of support that 100%.
So looking at that election of President Obama, the first black president in the United States, how does that inform what's happening now? Has it changed anything, or was that sort of a one-off, a special case?
I don't know that it was a one-off, but what I can say is that was a very momentous time for the United States, right? Like, there was a lot of energy, especially around young voters. I remember I was in college at that time, and I remember the sort of palpable energy for this presidential election. I mean, young people came out in droves, like this was all reported, right? So that was very special about that election year. This year, I think the way our election, the way our presidential election and the cycle has developed, there has just been so many sort of things that have come out of left field that people haven't expected. You know, Donald Trump being the presidential frontrunner when nobody really expected that at the beginning. It's just, I think, a really strange election year. I don't know that it's that, you know, President Obama's initial election in 2008 is the only time that identity will matter in that way in our presidential elections. But this is certainly a more nuanced and unique and diverse election cycle this year.
Maria, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Maria Muriel, digital editor at Public Radio International, where she recently reported on identity politics in the United States. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. If you spend time on social media like Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, chances are that you come across photos and stories about children that are posted by their parents or their grandparents or a relative. Sometimes it's that the child scored a soccer goal, got an A on a test, or had a great time with their cousins. But other times, it might be that they looked funny while they were napping, that they had a meltdown in the backseat of the car, or maybe something worse. Well, recent research shows that children don't want parents to post about them on social media as much as the parents seem to want to post, and they'd like to be asked before anything is put online. KJ Dell'Antonia is a columnist and contributing editor for the New York Times Well Family, and she joins us now. KJ, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we've talked a lot in the past about safety issues of posting pictures of children, but this is different. This is what do the children want in terms of what is posted about them? What does the research find?
Well, this was really interesting. Researchers reached out to a group of families, to parent and child pairs, with kids aged 10 to 17, and basically they asked them an open-ended question. Parents, what rules would you like your family to have about social media? And kids, what rules would you like your family to have about social media? And a striking number of children, far more than parents, said that they would like to have rules about privacy, about what their parents could post on social media, particularly about them.
And what did the parents say?
Well, most of the parents just didn't come up with that. It was an open-ended question, inviting you know, to list any rules that they wanted. And the parents tended to have stuff like, you know, no social media during dinner and no sharing your private information and things like that. A few of them had rules about talking about what was posted if it had to do with another family member. But by and large, it was the kids who said, don't post about me without asking, or even just don't post about me at all.
What were the concerns of the children? I think that the age group here was pretty wide. Wasn't it something like 10-year-olds to 17-year-olds?
It's 10 to 17, and the researchers told me that they did see a trend towards more of the kids that wanted this were older than were younger. So the older the kids got, the less they wanted to be shared on social media. And when I ran out and interviewed some kids myself, some of what I heard was that, you know, their friends might follow their parents, so their friends might be seeing these posts. And also just a general sense of being out there, having an online record about themselves that they didn't create, which, of course, then makes you think back about all the other things that you've posted about your kids on social media. And, you know, we all have. And there they all are. They have these online histories that are not of their own making.
So the idea sort of being that someone's dad takes a picture of their 15-year-old asleep in the back car, posted on Instagram, and that can be out there, and the kid may never even know about it themselves until someone else sees it. It might not be a flattering picture. And it sounds as though this has actually happened in real life and has caused some kids to endure ridicule. So you can understand that the children are developing sensitivities about it. Are parents ready to respond?
I think parents have seemed to be pretty responsive. I think that part of the question is just that it doesn't necessarily occur to a parent until the child asks, especially if the child is on the younger end of the spectrum. Once your kid is 14 or 15, I think the parent who would post a picture of them asleep in the back of the car, at least on Instagram, without asking, well, gosh, I hope that parent is rare, because it's not going to be long before your kid knows about that one. But, you know, when they're 9 or 10, they are just at the edge of becoming sensitive about that. But as parents, we're not necessarily thinking about it on their behalf. To us, they're just still, you know, so cute.
Is that sort of insensitivity on the part of parents? Because we hear, I mean, as a grown-up, you hear all the time that this is forever. I mean, you hear this directed at college students, so don't post, for instance, your drunk pictures, because they're going to be there forever and ever, and someone can enter the right terms or go to the right site, and there they are. And I suppose the same applies here.
I think it does, but it's hard to think about your 9-year-old in that context. You know, when you're at the point of talking to your own teen about what they're posting, then it probably is a good moment when your teen might say something to you about what you're posting. But with younger kids, I think, you know, this is all very new. We're really growing into this together, parents and kids. Facebook's been around just for, a little over 10 years. Instagram's been around, I think, for less than 5 years. I have the actual date somewhere. Twitter, not very low. Twitter just sent 10th anniversary email today. Yeah, so we know that one. But it's not very long. We haven't had, you know, we don't have our adult children saying, geez, I wish you had not done that to me, because, you know, no one did. It just didn't happen. So we're really learning about this together, which makes it unusual.
We're talking with KJ Dell'Antonia right now, columnist and contributing editor for the New York Times Well Family. And she recently wrote about kids wanting more say in what their parents post about them on social media. Is there ever pushback, KJ, from the parents saying, well, you know, I want people to see these family pictures of us, and I want the likes, and I want the memories. So how do you negotiate that?
I think there's a little pushback for kids that, you know, that want a total ban. A total ban, I think, is a little harder for a kid to persuade parents into than just a can I see it first. And I mean, even with my kids, I've certainly, and I do ask, and I've asked and said, but, you know, this is what's wrong with this? No, this is great. And at once I got, I want to share the picture of my winning team on Instagram before you do. All right, fair enough. Right. I can get that. So, but that hadn't necessarily occurred to me, because I don't think of that child as someone with an incredibly active Instagram life. So, you know, there are a lot of things behind this from our kids' points of view that we are just not necessarily thinking about yet.
Well, I suppose, I mean, to take it to a different level, and maybe this is a little on the fringe of what you're talking about here, but there have been cases of parents exercising poor judgment, or even of using social media as a shaming tactic, and that seems like a whole other ball of wax.
Oh, my gosh. Did your mind just go straight to the parent who shot his child's laptop?
I didn't see that.
Oh,
that sounds
that
like a great
like
example.
Years ago, I would say that was an example of things your child would not want you to put on the internet. But probably once you have a father who's firing weapons at your gadgetry, you may have other problems. That was another and complicated story. But yeah, there are going to be parents who are going to make bad calls about this. There are always going to be parents that are going to make bad calls. And one person that I talked to, Stacey Steinberg, she's a legal skills professor at the Center on Children and Families at the University of Florida College of Law. She was actually talking about how she suspects that later on we're going to start to see cases where kids want things taken down that their parents have put up. And she suggested that we may eventually be looking at some kind of something like what the European Union has, the right to invisibility, or it's something along the lines. I can't remember the exact phrase they use, but it's a right to somehow have things erased. And of course, Facebook and Instagram, I think at this point, would say, well, we can't do that easily, but it may come to a point where they're going to have to figure out how to do it easily.
Right. I was just going to ask you, are there any legal protections that children have about what can be posted about them?
No, it's the Wild West. Well, I mean, other than the obvious.
Right.
Pornography.
So then it comes down to a conversation between a parent and a child about what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. I mean, you write about in your piece, a parent may say, well, I wrote about your tantrum because I needed, or your picky eating because I wanted some help, and I got some help. And the child might be embarrassed about that. So how do you recommend navigating those waters?
Well, not if you're going to reach out to your community for help on, you know, an issue that your child might not be thrilled about later, picky eating or potty training or, you know, with an older kid, tantrums or homework struggles, maybe choose not to use your child's name in the post. You know, instead of writing about, you know, Dylan, write my son. And don't maybe use a picture on stuff like that. Just keep it a little bit more, you know, just be a little bit more reserved about the whole thing. Maybe limit it to friends instead of public, that kind of thing. Parents really do need to be able to reach out to our communities. It is helpful. It's helpful for the parents and it's helpful for the kids to have a parent who has that kind of support. But I think that there are ways of not necessarily making it the most searchable thing ever. I mean, a little tweet about your kid's tantrum or even a Facebook, how are you guys dealing with tantrums, is going to be a lot less searchable in the long run than your YouTube video.
We're talking with KJ Dell'Antonia right now. She is a columnist and contributing editor for the New York Times Well Family, talking about kids wanting to have more of a say in what their parents post about them on social media. Research shows that they do want more of a say. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you decide what to post about your own children on social media? Have you ever sat down with them and had a talk like this about what their preferences are, or held back from posting something that you wanted to post, but maybe they didn't want you to post it? Call 800-642-1234, or you can also post on our Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our conversation now about how and what children want their parents to post about them on social media and how parents can balance those desires with their own. And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you and your children had that talk about what their preferences are for posting stuff? Have you gone along with they want, with what they wanted, what they asked for? Did it seem reasonable? How did you negotiate? And do you think it matters when you consider the age of a child, how old they are? And again, we're not talking about safety here, but we're talking about a desire among children for privacy and making some of the decisions themselves. You can call us at 800-642-1234. KJ Dell'Antonia is with us. She's the lead writer and editor of the New York Times Motherlode Adventures in Parenting blog. And we go now to Mary Ann joining us in Crystal Lake. Mary Ann, hi.
Hi. Hold on. It just occurred to me, you know, out of the blue that, you know, how would you like it if your child posted when mom and dad maybe had one too many beers or something, you know, and got into something. So I just think I can't imagine doing that. I can't imagine. Just there's a lot of good insight from UK, that baby center in UK. I just think it seems more how I raised my kids 30 years ago, because now I have a grandson. He was just in, and his mother left to go to a shower. They flew in from the East Coast, so, you know, he's going through O'Hare, and it's traumatic for me, you know, when I'm over 55. But he stood at the door and screamed, and I was like, you know, I was like, to my husband, get up here, you know, and he calmed him down because I tried everything, you know, and I was just worried he was going to get sick, you know, and then it took time, and because I didn't want to put on a video because I thought he gets fed in daycare, you know, grandma and grandpa time, but I tried everything, and he just wanted to be with his grandpa for some reason, but my daughter did say that he plays a lot with the father more, and she's, you know, since she was nursing, but he's done with that for
right.
Over
and
a
year. So you wouldn't want some of that posted online, some of the emotional ups and downs that the grandson is going through. And going back, KJ, to Marianne's original point about, you know, what if the kids posted stuff about the parents having a couple too many drinks or something? Turn around would not be so fun for the parents. So that might be an interesting perspective for people.
Well, exactly. And I think, especially as our kids start to go onto social media, we have to think about what it would be like to be living in a house with, you know, two or three or four other people, all of whom were just waiting for your weakest nose-picking moment to put, you know, a picture of you up online. And that would be awful. One of the results for me of talking to these women about this research was to set an all-family rule, which we had talked about but hadn't necessarily really done anything about, that no one puts any pictures of anyone up anywhere without asking first.
And how has that worked out?
Well, it's fine. I mean, my kids are not particularly young, particularly old. It's not been an issue. But, you know, we have had a time when, you know, one sister had a cute picture of the other and wanted to post it, and the sister didn't want to be on Instagram for whatever reason. And so there have been discussions. The conversation has started, and I think that that's a really good place for us to be.
Right. So, and another aspect of this, talking about, you know, the sister story, it makes me think about how, especially when they get into the teenage years, kids get really embarrassed. They don't want to be seen with their parents. They don't want to hang out with their parents, so they're not going to want their parents posting about them. So do you think it's going to be difficult for people as we get into these, more and more kids hit this mark and parents hit this mark, where they're in those overly embarrassed years where parents may want to have a little more latitude than their kids are willing to give them?
Yeah, I could see, you know, you want to post the selfie of you and your kid on their birthday or whatever. And I've talked to some parents that have said that now whenever they get out the camera, their kids, you know, they throw hands up. They just won't do anything, and or they turn it back. And I can remember a dad saying to me that the only pictures he ever gets of his teenage son at this point are blurs as the son, you know, zips out of the room. And some of that is just a teen wanting some privacy and being ornery, and some of it is that the pictures, you know, we've shared so many in the past. I think if you overstep the bounds, the results are going to be clear.
Well, we've got a line for you right now at 800-642-1234. Do you think about this before you post pictures of your kids? Do you think about whether they'll want it there 5 years from now, 10 years from now? Do you ask them if it's okay? And do you think you might start doing that? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And KJ, it seems like this is something that parents and children could revisit over the years as they both grow and change and the technology changes, that this is not a one-stop conversation. It's an evolving conversation.
It's absolutely an evolving conversation. And whether you want to bring it up yourself with your child or wait until they do it, or just, you know, maybe step back on the sharing of images as they get a little bit older, that's a personal family choice. But I think it's going to be something we're going to talk about over and over and over again. And I also think the question of siblings is actually really interesting, because, I mean, that hasn't even come up, as far as I know, in research or anywhere else. But your sibling could certainly be just as damaging, if not more so, to your online reputation than your parent.
Do you think there should be guidelines about this? Is this something we should take seriously enough that, you know, maybe the pediatrician should be talking about it? How seriously should we take it?
I think I'm inclined to take it fairly seriously. You know, we do talk with our kids, most of us, about, like you said, how things never go away. And so, you know, an image that, and now I'm sort of mentally onto the sibling thing, but an image that your sibling shares in a weak moment that is really embarrassing for you could follow you through high school. And anyone who's been through high school can just sort of immediately start imagining what that could be like. And I guess I do think it's reasonably important. It's a little not fun, you know, because it is so much fun to pop up a funny picture of your kid, or, you know, to snag a shot of your 12-year-old wearing a goofy hat and doing the silliest possible thing. But, you know, it really is important to give that a little thought from the kid's point of view, and whether or not if you put that hat on and made your goofiest possible face, you would necessarily really want that on a professional networking site or something like that.
Let's take another call here. We've got Mary joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
I was just going to say that I have two teens, and they've been on social media probably for 4 years, and I have a lot of rules for them, and I try to follow those same rules. So if they want to see my Facebook page, they don't have Facebook, but they have Instagram. I follow them, they follow me, and I have the same standards. So I don't overshare, I don't complain about them, and they can see whatever is posted.
How is that working out so far? Is it working for your family?
It is. And I follow them on Instagram. They follow me. And to me, it's you're constantly learning. You know, you're constantly talking about maybe what, you know, if other kids post things, like, why was that not okay? To me, it's always a constant. You always have to be talking to them about things.
Thanks for that, Mary. And KJ, what does that make you think of?
It makes me think that we are always learning. I just made a Facebook mistake the other day. I posted something complaining about an assignment that was given in one of my kids' class. And the child didn't complain because the children in question are on Facebook and never noticed and weren't photographed or anything like that. The teacher did. And I felt pretty sheepish. That was, you know, it was foolish. So I think we are all going to be sort of evolving with what kinds of rules that we expect our kids to follow and what kind of rules that we need to be following ourselves.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I think a lot of us feel better that a New York Times writer made a mistake on Facebook. So I guess it's a work in progress as a culture. We just have to learn the ropes as we go along, don't we?
We do.
Well, KJ, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
KJ Delantonia is a columnist and a contributing editor for the New York Times Well Family. She joined us there to talk about some new research that shows that children, they want a say in what their parents post about them on Facebook, maybe veto power too, and about how to start those conversations. Some spelling news out of Wisconsin. The state spelling bee was held last week in Madison with three winners going on to the national spelling bee in Maryland. For spelling bee fans, the words were tough, especially towards the end. There was nephrolith, which is a kind of kidney stone, ohm, which in this case is an electrical unit of resistance, and the winning word, pharmacognosy. Here's 7th grader Veronica Goveas from North Middle School in Menominee Falls.
Pharmacognosy.
P-H-A-R-M-A-C-O-G-N-O-S-Y, pharmacognosy.
We have a winner.
And by the way, pharmacognosy, probably not something you're going to use every day, is a medical term meaning the branch of knowledge concerned with medicinal drugs obtained from plants or other natural sources. Anyway, it's always great to celebrate a fellow Veronica, so congrats. And next stop for the top three Wisconsin State winners, the Scripps National Spelling Bee in Maryland, which happens the week of May 22nd. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.